Good morning. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be with all of you and to have you with us today as we continue to not only celebrate the importance of diversity and inclusion, but double down on our commitment to understand how culture matters, and it matters a lot. We've heard a bit about campus culture and the importance of that in supporting our students, but we know to truly develop talent in this country at scale, not only does campus culture matter, but a culture of completion matters a great deal as well. We are thrilled to have so many students with us today, and I'm going to invite some student all-stars to the stage right now. We know that we can learn so much from our students' lived experiences, and so we've asked a couple of students to come and talk about their struggle and success. Important to understand the transition challenges of our students as we think about equity by design with a student in mind. So I want to ask all of the students, Siri, Michael, Ilion, and Kevin, to come forward so we can hear from them. We had a fabulous late night experience 2 days ago. Because you know, the one time that you can get all the students is at 9 p.m. So we had a great call at 9 p.m. To talk a bit about their experiences. And so I'm going to let them introduce themselves to you and talk a bit about transition challenges and how they have worked to move forward. Let's start with Michael Sutton. Michael?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Michael Sutton. I am a...
Is on now? Yeah. Okay, thank you. Good morning. My name is Michael Sutton. I am a proud Jack Kent Cook scholar, from young scholar all the way up through graduate school now. I just completed my bachelor's at Duke University, and I'm a first year PhD at Columbia now.
Michael, you want to talk about your transition challenge? We'll do all of that together.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think my biggest transition challenge with college is strangely one I also had in high school as well. I think just being at a predominantly white institution and not seeing myself represented. I think that led to a lot of discouragement at some point, in part because I think a lot of confidence can be based on example, which you see as being capable, what's already been done. And being at Duke University, taking engineering classes, the majority of my time, I was the only black student in the class, not having once had a black professor. So, you know, sitting in class, taking these extremely difficult classes, I'm thinking, nobody in this class looks like me. I'm not being taught anyone looks like me. How do I think any of this is actually possible? And so that led to some degree of discouragement of, you know, am I trying something that I'm actually capable of? It also led to a feeling of pressure because, you know, academically, I didn't really want to ask for help in classes. I didn't want, you know, my peers thinking, you know, or my professor thinking, the one black kid in the class, oh, he needs help. I also was wary of the type of assumptions that some people might make as a result. You know, are my peers looking at the one black kid in the class and thinking certain things based on how I behave or how I perform? So I think me not seeing myself represented in a lot of my college life was the biggest transition challenge for me.
Thank you. Ilion?
My name is Lillian Lackham. I am a
My
name is Lillian Lackham. I'm a proud graduate of Prince George's Community College. I currently attend Georgetown University. Speaking about my challenges, the first one is that I am an immigrant, so I'm originally from Africa. And I landed here, and I have no English skills. I'm still learning English as of now, and I had to adapt. I was coming from a high contest culture and very kind of like collectivist, and I landed into a low contest culture, individualistic. I was trying to process that, and as I was trying to process that, I also needed to learn English, and I went to college. That's why I started college at the community college, because I couldn't afford college. I couldn't afford education. I really wanted to pursue my education, but the 4 years university was very high. I couldn't afford them. So I landed at the community college, and it was kind of a little brutal, not that there were no resources for me, but around me, when I was speaking, I had a French accent, and some people were just having fun and laughing at me, or, you know, pretending, what are you saying? So I felt really, really frustrated, and it's kind of affected me in a way that at one point I tried to, like, I told myself that maybe I don't belong here, maybe I should try to just stop this, it's not gonna work, I don't know English and all that. And fortunately, the community college where I went to, the president is really into diversity, and it's actually a diversity community on campus. And they contacted me and they started working with me. And as I was going through the transformation step, I really wanted to help others. So I started being an advocate on campus, and I became the student member of the board of trustees. I joined the honors program. I took a lot of honors classes. I graduated with a 4.0, and I transferred to Georgetown University. And so when I received my acceptance letter, I got accepted in all the schools that I wanted. Georgetown was my number one priority because of the Jesuit value. When I received my acceptance letter, as soon as I screamed, I stopped and I said, wait, where am I going? This was going to be another step. I was going to move from a predominantly black college to a predominantly white college. So I just stopped there. Like, I just stopped. I couldn't even rejoice anymore. And I started breaking down. Like, what am I going to do? And unfortunately, there's a girl who contacted me from Georgetown University. She did not know me. She is from a different ethnicity background than I am. She's white. She started talking to me. She said she's from the Student Alliance and she's from a group of students. She really helped me transition without even knowing me. I met her 3 months after, but she already talked to me about, and this is something that really helped me to be able to find a new home at Georgetown University.
Great, thank you. Kevin?
Aloha kakahiaka.
Push your button. There you go.
Aloha kakahiaka, everybody. That's good morning in Hawaiian. My name is Kevin. I'm originally from Hawaii. I'm currently a sophomore in the University of Richmond, majoring in biochemistry with minors in mathematics and integrated science. Going to University of Richmond is, I think it's, I did not expect to be in that university, to go to that university. Not because of this program I got into in my junior year of high school called Leadership Enterprise for a Diverse America. It is an organization that highly committed in diversifying and getting those underrepresented students in the nation's top colleges. So where I came from in Hawaii is predominantly low-income neighborhood. If not, it's probably the most low-income neighborhood in the state of Hawaii. So when I get into the University of Richmond, I found out that there are 4 people from my class who's from Hawaii, and 3 of them came from private school, and I'm the only one who came from public school. So when I walk into my class, it's a special program. It's a special class called Integrated Quantitative Science. So we're trying to solve problems using math, biology, physics, computer science, and in an interdisciplinary level. So in that class, many of my classmates came from really privileged neighborhood that they had so much resources. Some of them took differential equations in high school. Some of them took organic chemistry in high school, and I'm just here. I had to learn AP Calculus BC on my own to get the credit for Calc 2. So when we get our tests, like, we had our first test, and you can see the correlation of, like, I could see, if I compare myself in their performance, they get the class. It's easy for them to take the class, but I am behind in the class. So that's, but I was kind of lucky that my, there's a first year seminar course. It is required for all freshmen in the University of Richmond. I was lucky that my professor required us to meet with the academic skills counselor in the University of Richmond, and that's how I got to learn the resources that I have in the University of Richmond. So every time I had a test, I had to meet, if I see the professor, we always talk about how could I prepare for this test. I came from this background, and I feel like I have shortcomings. Could you help me with this? And the counselor in the University of Richmond are really helpful. And she happened to be a person of color, and she's also from a low-income background. So that really worked out for me really well.
Great. Thank you. Josiah?
Hello, everybody. My name is Joshea Trotman, and I'm a third year at Brown University studying cell and molecular biology. And I wanted to tell you guys a little bit of background information. I'm from a really small plot of land, very impoverished, in the middle of one of the richest towns in America. I'm from Indian Reservation in the middle of the Hamptons. So you can already tell the differences alone there. And majority of us don't make it. And I can tell you some numbers. About 30 of us went to our public high school in Southampton, and only 10 of us graduated. And out of those 10, 4 of us went to college. I'm the only one that in my entire community, I think there's actually only 2 of us who've been to an Ivy League institution. Yes, like I said, most of us don't make it. And our family, professors tell us that we're not going to make it. Our peers tell us that we're not going to make it. Even my parents told me I wasn't going to make it, because that's just the constant movement of our community. And it wasn't until the summer after my junior year when I joined Leadership Enterprise of a Diverse America that I realized I could do this. This program, I didn't actually know what an Ivy League institution was until that summer, right before my senior year. I wasn't planning on going to college until that summer before my senior year. My father told me that right after I applied to my 10 colleges, first semester of my senior year, he said, if you don't get a full ride to any of these schools, I don't know where you think you're going. I hope you're going to the community college down the street, if that. And it is things like these that make us need programs like LEADA. And I really want to tell you guys that it starts in high school. Even though we're thinking about higher education, it really, really starts in high school. That's when we need to know that we can do it, because if we don't, we are going to listen to those peers and those professors and the people that are closest to us. Like I said, even my parents that tell us that we're not going to make it. And yeah, that's how I overcame it. Thank you, LEADA.
Thank you. Syra?
Hi, everyone. I'm Syra Alanis. I'm Syra Alanis, and I am also a very proud LEADA scholar. I'm originally from a very small town in South Texas called Los Rezos, Texas. It's right on the border with Mexico, and I am a Rice University alum, and now I'm living in New York City working for LEADA full-time, actually. So my journey to college definitely wasn't an easy one. It wasn't a straightforward one. I was very lucky in that my parents, from when I was a very small child, they did tell me that I needed to go to college. They sacrificed a lot for me to be able to get an education in this country, and so that was a given. What I didn't know was that I would be leaving my home to go to college. I always just assumed that I would be going to college closest to where I live. It wasn't for LEADA, actually. They showed me, they dared me to dream, and they showed me that I could go somewhere. Somewhere where I could get access to more resources and have the type of education that I was able to have at Rice. Some of the transition challenges that I did have at Rice were for 3 different reasons. One is because I'm a Latina, another is because I'm first gen, and the last is because I'm low income. There are a lot of hidden costs that come with going to a highly selective university or just a university at all. Costs that I didn't anticipate, things that made my everyday life a lot more stressful. I was dealing, just like everyone else, with having to go to this very rigorous university. I was trying to catch up to my peers, and I was also trying to survive. that was something that persisted throughout all 4 years of my college experience. Another one was, and it's also something that I still struggle with today, it's learning how to ask for help. I would watch my peers, my wealthy white peers, asking for help all the time. So it really didn't make sense for me to feel that I couldn't, but I felt that way anyway, because to me, that was admitting defeat. It was admitting that I didn't deserve the spot that I had at my university. It was difficult, especially at the beginning when I was, like I said, still trying to catch up, when I was trying to balance everything that was going on in my life. And the last was the culture shock. I'm from South Texas. It's a predominantly Mexican-American community. I really hadn't interacted with any other races outside of my summer at LIDA. And learning how to talk to people, how to teach them about myself, something that I really had never had to do before, how to deal with all the racist encounters that I would have, both on campus and off campus. It was difficult. It was difficult not having a community to be able to talk to about that. Those are a little bit about me.
So we are so proud of these students for their tenacity, the work that they have done. This is what talent development looks like in our great country. But I want to ask the students, as framing for the idea of folks who are coming up, if you will just say quickly for the practitioners and those in the room who care so deeply about this, one recommendation that would have made a difference for you. Let's start as Syria and go across.
So I think a really important thing is to acknowledge that we are different. And I think being here is so inspirational. I thank you all for all the work that you're doing. I thank you for caring. I think it is important to make sure that we are succeeding in these communities, but it's also important to make sure that we have someone dedicated to ensure that we have everything that we need, that we're okay mentally, that we're okay financially. It's great that students are being active, that we are there for each other, and those micro communities are awesome, but we also need help. We need help in ensuring that even the mentors are okay, the mentees are okay, that we need trained professionals that can help us from beginning to end, because like I like to say, the first gen struggle doesn't end. And so that would be my biggest suggestion, trained professionals that can help us.
Thank you. Michael, quickly.
I would just say a couple things. The first is for the universities to appreciate student stories more than statistical branding. I know, you know, if you look at Duke's admission page right now, it highlights, oh, we have X number of students of color and they're from this and from that. But to actually sit down and say, I acknowledge that you're coming from a different background than the majority of your peers. How are you doing? Is there anything we can be doing as a university to actually help? I think that's a conversation that's not had enough. And it's one that I think a lot of students would benefit from. And the second is just to echo Kimberly's sentiments that it's a representation thing. Like, you know, yes, there are issues with, you know, a lot of underrepresented minorities not really pursuing the higher education. I know me personally, I hope to become a professor to be part of that change. But it's also an issue of universities recruiting those individuals who are already at that point and keeping them, as well as various students of color,
Thank you.
Making sure they're staying up who they need to be.
Great, thank you. Ileana?
Thank you. I like to say that diversity should go with inclusion. If the college is just diverse, it doesn't make sense. Everybody has to feel safe. Everybody has to belong there. It's about belonging. It's not just about having black or white or Hispanic in the college. When I walk on a campus and I see black walking together, white walking together, and Hispanic walking just together, it really hurt me. And a college should not be like that. It shouldn't look like that. And we really look forward for a program that's going to kind of teach people what diversity is and how to interact with each other. Because cultural competency and interfaith competency is really important in today's world. School is not just to get degree, it's to go to tomorrow and to change the world. So I really hope that practitioners will kind of work for strategy that will implement those thoughts and those beliefs. And also, I will just agree with you that we shouldn't just be looking at numbers. We are very different, and those differences should be really taken into consideration in anything we do. It should be taken into consideration in the image that we use to kind of showcase the college. Everybody should feel like representing in those images, because I like theology, and one of my favorite theologians is Tillich. He said that we use symbol to represent the truth. If somebody look at a symbol, the symbol should grab you. If you look at an image of a college and you only see your peer worldwide, that means that maybe you don't belong there. Also, the language that we use for some program, if you create a program to help low-income students, don't just say that, okay, this is a program for low-income students, because they're not gonna seek for help. It's just like they might feel intimidated. So
images matter and language matters. Anything that you haven't heard from either of you quickly? Push your button.
I just want to focus on the diversity of low-income socioeconomic backgrounds. In an institution like University of Richmond, I think it's important that professors have to acknowledge that people from different income backgrounds might have different knowledge of a certain subject. Like, for example, student A from a rich community might had a lot of background in organic chemistry, and student B from a low-income background have a little bit knowledge of that subject. And when you put them together in classroom, the professor might teach at a certain level with the assumption that every student is equal.
Right.
That's really I do think that's really unfair. So it is important to let faculties know that the work of student success is 50-50. Part of it is the students working hard, and the other 50% is the professors knowing the best way of teaching for that specific student.
Good, Kevin. Thank you. Anything else?
Yes. I want to go back to what Ms. Griffin said. Mentorship. That is a key. We have to see people that look like us in these positions in order for us to have some type of guidance. All my life, I was told I had to assimilate to a specific demographic in order to make it. And contrary to my fro, I had straight hair, and I tried to lighten my skin, and I tried to do all the things so that I can make it and I can assimilate to that demographic. And we can't have that anymore. We have to make it how we look right now. We have to make it how we are right now. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking this panel. I'm so happy that we have, as I mentioned, so many students who will be with us throughout this day. We will learn from their lived experiences. We think it's very important that we continue to lift them up, hopefully to remove barriers, and certainly to be committed to their success. So please thank them. So you can grab your name tags, and then our IDEO friends are going to come. Talk a bit about the framing of the importance of equity by design with a student in mind. Buttons are on.
It couldn't have been a better setup. Thank you to the students for sharing your experiences. You're really why we're here today. And it's really important your voice continues to be present in this dialogue. So we're here to talk about the role design can play in making colleges a better experience, really for you all. And I'm just gonna start with this one note. It feels pretty important. There's a tone here today, and I think this is a really important thing to keep in mind. It's a value that our organization and designers, period, hold dearly, which is be optimistic. So design is really an outlook on the world that says all those challenges, every single one that you mentioned today, I see those challenges and I say that is an opportunity for design. There is something that we can do about that. And it's not just blind optimism. It's backed by this. It's backed by a deep sense of responsibility and agency to say, and I'm going to do something about that. So it's really designed as sort of this form of generative activism, if you want to think of it that way. So I'll take a step back and just introduce myself. I'm Heather. I'm a designer at IDEO. And I'm joined here today by Richard Culotta, who is formerly with this great administration at the Department of Ed, currently in a role as the Chief Innovation Officer at with the state of Rhode Island. And we're very fortunate to have him also as a creative resident with our team. And I want to give you just a little bit of context about why am I here in the kind of this landscape of the experts and the students who are having these deep experiences. I represent this organization. At this point, this organization and myself are inseparable in the values that we share. And why design? So IDEO is a global leader in design and innovation. We've been around 30 years. We have 8 offices around the globe, 600 people. And you know, what IDEO's sort of claim to fame, we designed the first Apple mouse, the first laptop, the first soft-handled toothbrush. But the thing that we're really best known for is an approach to solving problems. That approach is known as design thinking. Our founder sort of wrote the book on design thinking. And that approach really believes that any challenge that you want to solve starts with one incredibly important lens, and that lens is empathy. That lens is, how do you deeply understand the needs of those who you're designing for? Much like David Yeager, our founders brought methods of psychology and anthropology into the practice of design. And so that is the starting point for every challenge. And we've applied that lens in pretty much every industry and sector, from healthcare to financial services to education. So our team who's here today actually focus on bringing the power of design as a tool to solving some of the biggest challenges in education. We work across, you know, people always say, well, what facet of education? We work across K-12 through higher ed, all the way through to adult learning and lifelong learning. And, you know, we've been seeing particularly a series of patterns in the work we've been doing in the last few years that I think echoes a lot of what I heard from the students here today, which is when you think about what is the change that higher ed needs to see, I think it's recognizing that there's a trajectory, and you know that trajectory begins in the K-12 system and it continues on to career, and in that trajectory there's transitions across that. And today those transitions for students, particularly students who come from backgrounds that they don't have the same support networks that some of their peers may have, those transitions feel like handoffs or in some cases total chasms in an experience. And a lot of students, too many students, are really falling through the cracks in those experiences. So we've been doing a lot of work to think about what's the role design can play in bridging those gaps in transition. We've worked across that spectrum. We've been thinking about how do you expose students in as early as high school to career pathways so that you aren't thinking about for the first time your junior year of college about declaring a major. We've been doing a lot of work thinking about what the K-12 system might be missing and it's striving toward sort of checking the boxes to make sure that all students are prepared to go to college is actually sort of a question of why do they want to go, what do they intend to do, and what's the role that design can play in helping students discover their purpose and have that purpose to hold on to as they're moving through those experiences. A lot around navigating the transitions that we heard the student panel talk about. We've worked with a wonderful organization, Beyond 12, to do a lot of the things that I heard helped you through those experiences, how to provide support in everything from belonging to thinking about how to sign up for classes to navigate financial aid. And then finally, recognizing that when you think about delivering a great student experience in college, you also have to realize that there's another stakeholder in that system, which is the career that they may land in one day. And are we preparing those students with the skills that are resonant with the employers on the other end? And if we aren't doing that, we're also failing. So some patterns here. And really, you know, one of the observations that we're making across the work that we've been doing is that, I think not surprisingly, that the needs of this new student population, the needs that we said, you know, acknowledge that there are different needs that this population faces. These first generation students, you know, increasingly the new majority college student is not coming straight out of high school, or if they are, they're first generation students, students of color, or they're returning, they're adults who are returning to reskill, or they're, you know, working parents, and so they face a different set of challenges, and the current system isn't doing a very good job of supporting these challenges and recognizing these differences and really understanding how to personalize and design for them. I want to acknowledge that that there has also been great progress. Really inspiring to hear all of the ingredients that we had today, from the important policy work that's been happening to the research, to increasingly the role that data is playing in helping shed light on what are the areas that actually we might have great impact. What are the problems? But you know, the kind of data can only go so far. We really believe that design is sort of the thing that you do with the data. What do you do? How do you act upon that data in ways that really support student success? So we believe equity is an experience that can be designed unequivocally. You know, we heard from Peyton, we heard from Dan Yeager that about the importance of designing an experience. That's what we want to share a little bit today, is what do we mean when we talk about experience design, this word UX. So I'm going to invite my colleague up here to talk a little bit about what UX design is, and the breakout session we're going to be running this afternoon is all about unpacking this and giving you the tools to do so.
Thank you. I got the clicker too. Thanks, Heather. Heather is an incredibly talented designer, one of the most talented designers I've ever met, and we're really lucky that she's applying her talents to the education space on so many levels. So when she mentioned that asked me if I'd help with this session, I said, yes, absolutely, I'm happy to jump in. As Heather mentioned, my role, I'm the Chief Innovation Officer for the state of Rhode Island, also honored to be serving as a fellow resident with IDEO. But also incredibly honored to have served for 5 years in the Obama administration. Particularly my role, my charge from the president was looking at how we could use technology to close persistent equity gaps. And so some interesting work that that has really shaped a lot of my thinking. Today's conversation is so interesting because we're combining a couple pieces, which is why I think it's going to be such a rich conversation. Early, we sort of started off with a real heavy focus on the legal context that makes this all happen, and it is critical that we are thinking about very thoughtfully what are the, sort of the legal and regulatory context that we sit in to ensure equity. But at the same time, we have to be really clear that an equitable experience in a higher ed institution does not come only because we have created a legal context for it to live in, right? And that's important. I wish it did. I wish we could just take care of the laws and then have the experience on campus be equitable. Unfortunately, it is not. It's not that easy. And so we have to be equally as thoughtful about the legal context as the experience that we're creating when the students arrive. So what I'm going to try to do here is in 3 minutes, give you a crash course on what it means to be a user experience designer. There we go. So here it is. I'm gonna teach this. Some people go to school for this for years, sometimes get a PhD in it. You're gonna be up to speed in 3 minutes. Here we go. The first part of being a user experience designer is understanding the user, surprisingly enough. And yet, it's one of the things that we are most struggling with when we think about the experience of higher education. And so for user experience, really, the only piece you have to know, this is your first semester in UX design, is if we're going to create a user experience that is equitable, we have to know who our users are. And there's a whole variety of tools that we can use to figure that out. We're going to share some more. For those of you that are joining the session this afternoon, we'll share a variety of those tools. But one of my favorites is a tool simply known as user shadowing. User shadowing, it's the idea of saying, actually go and follow a student through their day. I mean, with their permission, of course. It's creepy if you don't do that. But right, with their permission, go ask their student if you can follow them and see how the experience on campus fits in with their broader life and how specific experiences relate to what they are doing. These are two two of my favorite college presidents. One of them is Megan Hughes, who's the president of our community college system in Rhode Island, and Alfonso, who's sitting right here, actually works on her team. One of the things that she did when she first came in to lead our community college system, which was badly in need of a new lens to look through user experience, she picked a student to go shadow. Jose, I think was his name, right? Went and shadowed this kid, just met him in the morning, walked through his day, figured out, went through with him as he went to school and came back. And one of the things that she noticed immediately that has probably existed for decades in Rhode Island and nobody noticed until she did this was how misaligned the RPTA, our bus system, the Rhode Island Public Transportation, the RPTA bus system schedule was with the community college course schedule. This kid had to go from, I don't remember how far it was. It was a couple miles. It wasn't that far. It was something that I think she said that if she had driven, it would have taken about 15 minutes. And it was taking him almost 2 hours each direction because of the misalignment. He'd have to go to another part of the city, wait for another bus, even just to go right down the street. Something that we discovered, that she was able to discover very quickly, simply by going through the day in their shoes. And many, many other examples that I can give of this. I'm getting the, hey, time to shut up signal. So I'm going to skip President Sorrell's example for now, but come to our afternoon session, and I will tell you, he did user shadowing on his campus, Paul Quinn College, that resulted in turning the football field into a farm. So if that doesn't get you interested, then we will, it's now back up to 5. Whew. All right. I'll talk slower. We'll still tell you more about him, but he's really also had a very interesting experience by simply shadowing the users. Okay, second part of UX design is understanding there is an expectation of the users of the system, right? So an expectation of the system. What do we mean by that? Well, we mean that an expectation could be that all students expect that they have the opportunities to succeed on a college campus, right? That's one example of an expectation you may have. There are other expectations too. One is that I hear a lot, an expectation that all students believe they will get a good job if they go through the system. It's an expectation we have set up. Now, I'm not gonna weigh in on whether those are right or wrong. I think you probably guess where I land, but we have to recognize that if we're gonna build solutions, we need to know what the students are expecting. It's a very interesting one. I was talking to some college presidents, and they were talking about the expectation of getting a job. They said, "Well, that's not really our expectation that students will get a job. We just expect that they'll be good people as they walk out of here." And I said, "Okay, that's good. But let's walk into your English 101 class, and I'm going to ask your students if they expect that they're going to get a job out of this. And as long as they go, no, we're good. No, we don't. We just want to be good people. We don't expect to get a job. Then awesome, no problem." But if there's a misalignment, then we have a user experience problem that we have to deal with, right? So that's the second part. All right, third part. Oh, this is just here, yeah. You'll get this. This is a funny example of user experience that we will talk about more this afternoon, but I was just trying to show here, if you ever push on a door, right, you know where to push because there's that plate. Really funny thing to do if you've ever tried this, move that plate to the other side of the door. People are like, the door's locked, right? No, the only thing that plate does is it tells you how to interact with that door. It sets up a user experience. We do all kinds of things like that. David was up here a second ago talking about all the ways that we set the expectations of students when they come into higher ed. Need to be very thoughtful about where we place those door plates, right? You know, if we can use that analogy. Okay, here's my last one for real. And that is how students interact with the system. Students that interact with the system, I'm going to give a silly example to make the point, and then a more serious one, and then I will be done. And except for Heather's going to give a 30-second view of what you're going to do this afternoon if you come to our session. So here's the course catalog. This is a course catalog that you see at pretty much every institution that you go to in the United States, and you see the courses that are arranged how? In alphabetical order. But no student on the face of the planet has ever said, "I'm going to start with accounting and work my way through until I get to zoology." Right? We don't take courses in alphabetical order. So why do we present courses to students in alphabetical order? That's an example with the way that they interact with the system, in this case that I don't think makes a lot of sense. There are a whole variety of more serious ways that we need to be thinking about. We heard some here a little bit. Like, how do students get information from the school and what words are used in those letters that we heard about from David a second ago? Another interesting one that I think about is how we interact with the scholarship system. We provide scholarship money at the least useful time. We provide scholarships when students have already been accepted to the institution. Well, look, at that point, 90% is done. right? So the interesting thing would be to say, what if we were to start providing scholarships when they were freshmen in high school? Somebody mentioned up here a second ago, pushing this back to high school, and slowly getting your scholarship over time as you demonstrate competencies in high school as a lever to incentivize you to get all the way through. There are many, many more examples. One final one that I'll share is in Rhode Island, we started looking around at the experience, the interaction with the system, and saw that the cost of textbooks was incredibly high. So students were saying, we made it, we saved, we got financial aid, we got here, we thought we were good to go, and now I have to spend $1,000 in textbooks? I'm done. Like, that's it. That's the point where I'm done. And so we launched in Rhode Island, the first state to do this. Every college in the state has signed a challenge with the governor that they're going to transition thoughtfully over to open license textbooks, free textbooks. We plan to save $5 million for students in Rhode Island by not having to have to pay for textbooks. Right. Thank you. There are many, many more examples that we will talk about later. We're going to jump right to the next session because Cecilia's here. But we will talk about many other examples this afternoon. And in our session that we will host, if you join, we will actually have you help go through the design process, pick a problem, figure out what exactly we can do, and propose some possible solutions that can be implemented on your campuses in order to be able to attack some of these user experience problems. Thank you. You are now all UX designers. Congratulations. We'll see you this afternoon.
Good morning. It's still morning, right? Yeah, it's still morning. Good morning. That was awesome. I'm like now especially sorry that I missed more of the morning. My name is Cecilia Munoz. I'm President Obama's domestic policy advisor. And I'm super excited to see all of you here. And I heard there was a panel of students that I missed, but that was out of control wonderful. Am I right about that? I'm grateful to hear that, although I'm really sorry that I missed it. I should really have to start by saying thank you to everybody in this room for your incredibly hard work over the last several years. The work of making sure that we make the deepest and largest strides possible in higher education to make sure that people not only have access to higher education, but complete higher education has been the work of this administration since the very first day, and I have the privilege of saying that I started on the very first day, and I work for a president and for that matter, the president and the first lady, people who are deeply, deeply aware in their own lives of what access to quality higher education has meant to them, being able to be who they are and to be able to be successful, and who the president is deeply, deeply aware of what access to higher education means to our collective capacity to be successful. And so this is work that has been ongoing since the very beginning. And you know, we sort of start from the premise that where somebody starts in this country should never determine where they end up. We've spent a lot of time thinking and working on this notion of that your zip code should not be the ultimate determinant of how successful you are. And there are all kinds of policies in place that focus on that, but perhaps nothing more important than our policies in the education arena. And what you all in this room have demonstrated is what we can accomplish when we work collaboratively. So many of you, in fact, more than 700 college and university presidents, business leaders, counselors, nonprofits, and philanthropies stood up to answer the president and the first lady's call to college opportunity, which is really tremendously exciting. We have been doing what we can in the policy realm, but it's also incredibly, incredibly important to build communities of practice and coalitions that are working on this around the country, and you're the people who've answered the call. So the work you've done alongside leaders across the country has been absolutely vital in getting more students from disadvantaged backgrounds into college and through college, and you have to concentrate on both. And we've heard that the folks who have made commitments at our College Opportunity Summit are making great progress, which is really, really exciting. So new networks of colleges and universities are set to produce more than 10 million more students on track to graduate by 2025, which would help those families save at least $2 billion of tuition collectively. Colleges, universities, and organizations are working to save over 350,000 students from taking remediation courses unnecessarily, bettering the odds of timely college completion. Partnerships among K-12 schools, community colleges, and four-year colleges and universities have set goals and are pursuing collaborative strategies to help over 100,000 more students become college ready by tying together academic expectations, student support systems, community resources. This adding $135 million in new investments to higher education to strengthen success and catalyzing more than 40,000 new partnerships between high schools, colleges, counselors, access groups, nonprofits, and businesses. Tens of thousands of more students will gain access to high-quality college advising through the training of more than 5,000 school counselors and advisors in high-need districts and schools, helping students submit at least 6 million more college applications and enrolling about 1 million more students in college. Institutions and organizations have made more than 100 individual commitments towards the president's goals to graduate an additional 1 million STEM graduates and prepare 100,000 excellent K through 12 STEM teachers over a decade, with over 45 institutions setting an additional 100,000 STEM majors on track to graduate and projecting to 600,000 more STEM graduates by 2025. I love it when we're able to quantify our work in this way, right? It feels pretty good. Collectively, these efforts demonstrate, look, we have a lot more to do, but we're on the right track. The trend lines are moving in the right direction. Our work together has meant more historically underserved students are attending college. More students are graduating than ever before, and student loan defaults and delinquencies are finally declining. So everybody has played and will continue to play a role as part of that, these efforts to, and the goal to ensure that all students have access to an affordable, high-quality education. That's really what we're aiming at here. Policymakers at all levels, federal, state, and state government, can provide the resources and coordinate between schools and communities to promote college opportunity. We know that employers can invest in the knowledge and skills of their future teams. Foundations can invest in stronger research and best practices. Researchers can build the evidence base so that we can test and scale what works. Advisors can support students through these incredibly important decisions using some of the new resources and tools that we put in place, like the College Scorecard. And most of all, we know that students can do everything, and we are doing a lot to, and the First Lady more than anyone, to inspire students to work hard and make sure their education counts. So this model of shared responsibility is really the backbone of another effort that we're really proud of, the America's College Promise effort, which is this, the president's plan to make 2 years of community college free for responsible students. Community colleges serve 7 million undergraduates who reflect really the diverse population in this country. They tend to be older, lower moderate income, minority, first generation, and rural Americans seeking an opportunity to earn a quality, affordable degree and credential to meet the demands of this competitive global economy. And I'm proud to say that now, since the president's announcement of the America's College Promise program, there are over 100 free community college programs that have launched, and they serve well over 200,000 students. So it's a strong start with much, much more to go, but we've demonstrated the inspiration and are beginning to prove the theory of the case that this is something that we can do, and we can do it effectively, and we can reach a lot of students and make their pathway easier. So this is, it's a great example of how communities have gotten together to move this kind of program forward, and it demonstrates, as all of you have demonstrated in the work that you do, that change here is possible, progress is possible. We have started to make it together. We have started to make it in measurable ways. That's worth celebrating. And it is worth taking a minute to celebrate how far we've come, knowing that everybody in this room has their eyes fully on how far we still have to go. Today, in particular, we're focusing on advancing diversity and inclusion in higher education in particular, which is a way of deepening our collective work on college opportunity, this work which has been underway for all of these 8 years, and to lift up ways that we can make sure every student has access and every student succeeds and thrives at their institutions and beyond. So it's important to just take a minute to focus on what we can achieve together, because all of those numbers that I tick through really demonstrate that progress is possible and that it's possible on a significant scale. We've demonstrated when we collaborate, when we use research tools, when we use evidence effectively, when we make commitments and stretch ourselves to meet them, we can accomplish extraordinary things. As we've heard from all of you, we also know that this work can feel daunting, but part of the reason for going through the litany of what we've achieved and how the trend lines are moving is a way of demonstrating that we can keep at this, we can continue to identify strategies that work, we can continue to stretch ourselves by making these commitments, we can continue to demonstrate why this is so important to the country. And I'm confident that we're going to continue to make progress, and that's because of the hard work, the dedication, the commitment, the skill of all of the people in this room and many, many others like you all around the country that we have connected with that are working together and which are making the country a better place as a result of what you're doing. So my real job here is to say thank you. It couldn't be more important. It couldn't be more inspiring, and I believe just down to my core that it will be enduring. So thank you for that. And with that, I'd like to welcome Rini Sampath to the stage, who's going to introduce our next speaker. Rini, the stage is yours.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Celia. I really appreciate it, and I'm really honored to even go after you. So thank you. Good morning, everyone. How's everyone feeling? Good, good. Like to hear that. It's great to see you all here. Thank you to the White House and the U.S. Department of Education for putting this event together. It's truly extraordinary, especially at the time that we are in now, to have an event at the White House on diversity and inclusion. My name is Rini Sampath, and I am a recent graduate of the University of Southern California, where I served as a student body president. Today, I work as the Policy and Engagement Manager at the National Campus Leadership Council, where I work with student body presidents across the nation on national action strategies. As students, educators, administrators, and change makers, we're fortunate to have the tremendous support of this administration's leadership, serving both as a sounding board and platform for institutional change. Personally, this means a lot. I moved to the United States when I was 7 years old from India and Singapore. And as the first in my family to hold a degree from an American university, all this is pretty cool. But I remember being new here, and it wasn't the easiest transition. Most of the kids are actually not that nice to the immigrant girl with an accent. So I learned soon enough that it was my teachers who taught me my sense of self and helped me find my place in America. When I went to college, I saw firsthand how we need to come together to address racial intolerance, prevent harassment, and increase inclusion. Last fall, like many campuses across our country, USC ignited. While walking back from a football game, a racial epithet, along with a drink, was hurled at me out of a fraternity window. As an immigrant woman, I am no stranger to racism or sexism. I recounted the events of that night in a Facebook post, which went viral. But my story was not uncommon, especially at USC. Earlier that week, someone had called a student a homophobic slur. My freshman year, 79 LAPD officers arrested students at a predominantly black party while telling the predominantly white partygoers across the street to stay safe indoors. Throughout my time on campus, students vented their frustrations about racial profiling. So I thought I was lucky because I was student body president. My platform was able to bound faculty, educators, and staff together to fight for inclusion and diversity. But from the story, it's important that we remember we have to listen to all students, regardless of who they are, where they come from, or what status they hold on their campuses. As our speakers this morning emphasize, these big challenges are an opportunity to bring us together and to solve problems in better ways. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing a man who has led the charge to make higher education more inclusive and accessible for all people of this great country, people like me. For me, our next speaker inspires because he reminds me of every incredible teacher I've had from grade school to college. You just can't miss that about him. He's a teacher. Great teachers help their students overcome challenges and create space for dialogue. This is exactly the kind of leadership that we need, and our speaker reflects this. For me and many students admiring his leadership and service, this is an example for us that no matter where we come from or what obstacles we may face, we must stay hopeful, caring, and committed to doing what is right. Please, Join me in welcoming United States Secretary of Education, Dr. John King Jr.
Thanks so much, Rini, for that introduction and for sharing your experiences on your campus and for your leadership on your campus. And we know student leadership is going to be central to how we meet our greatest challenges, not only on our campuses, but as a country. I also want to thank the Jack Kent Cook Foundation for their support in making sure that we would have student voices, student leaders here today as part of this important conversation. And I want to thank all of you for engaging in today's dialogue on a crucial issue, one on which we all must work together to produce faster and necessary progress. Across the country, we continue to see schools and college campuses grappling with tough issues, including, unfortunately, increasingly responding to incidents of hate and racial harassment. Our nation's schools and colleges strive to set a high standard as places that celebrate diversity and work towards inclusion, free of bullying, harassment, and hate speech, and the defacement of places of worship and other shared public spaces. As educators, we have a responsibility to our students to make sure that our classrooms and campuses are safe and supportive places for all. We must ensure that our students never feel unwelcome or threatened or fear being emotionally or physically attacked. Today is as much about sharing strategies to build meaningful educational opportunity for students from all backgrounds as it is a reminder that education leaders and all of us must stand united against harassment, against bullying, against behaviors that lead students to feel less valued or unsafe on campuses because of their race, their religion, their country of origin, their native language, or disability, or socioeconomic status. And while talking about these issues is an important step, it's not enough. We must also show our values, those core values upon which our nation was built, in action. We must intentionally build inclusive spaces that invite positive and respectful interactions among diverse people and perspectives, and foster institutional structures designed to support lasting change. Our schools and our colleges and universities must stand as exemplars to the nation, demonstrating how to build strong, cohesive communities. Promoting supportive, inclusive campuses free of racial harassment is not only the right thing to do and a legal imperative, it also can help increase completion rates for disadvantaged students who can too often feel like they do not belong in college, or lead them to feel overwhelmed by the college experience, or even to feel like they are unsupported as they work towards graduation. Research supports that diverse campus environments produce students who are better prepared for the diverse world they must navigate after college, better prepared to exhibit the kinds of skills of empathy and inclusion that are central to success, not only in the workplace, but as citizens. And this matters because it's critical to improve civic engagement, and it's critical for the long-term success, not just of our economy, but of our democracy, that we deepen cross-racial understanding. And this work must carry on from efforts that begin in preschool and elementary school, into high school, and onto college campuses. And we worry that even now, more than 60 years after Brown versus Board of Education, we find communities where schools are more isolated by race and class than they were even 10 or 20 years ago. This is urgent cross-sector work. Every area of the educational system needs to focus on strength through diversity, from pre-K through K through 12 into higher education. I'm grateful to be in a room with so many champions of diversity and inclusion, including college and university presidents who've committed to increase diversity, to ensure safety on their campus, We have researchers in the room and practitioners who are working to build a stronger evidence base around the kinds of practices that make a difference for students feeling safe and included and supported through to completion. And we have student leaders here, leaders like Rainey, who are standing up on their campus for equity and excellence for all. The administration, as Cecilia has talked about, has made equity and inclusion hallmarks of our commitment in higher education. The report that we're releasing today, Advancing Diversity and Inclusion in Higher Education, is intended to encourage more colleges and universities to take up this cause and to build on lessons learned by many in the room. And certainly our commitment is not just to diversity in admissions and enrollment, but diversity in who graduates and diversity in how we think about what we value on our campuses. Now, certainly the administration has made significant investments to ensure broader access to college, and Cecilia talked about some of those investments. The significant increase in Pell dollars, the direct loan program that's moved more than $60 billion away from subsidies to banks towards students and taxpayers, the tax credit that's made it possible for families to access college more easily, the work we've done to move up the FAFSA, which we know opened on October 1, and everyone needs to remind everyone, you know, if you're tweeting right now, now's the moment, FAFSA opened on October 1. And also our work to simplify the FAFSA and to make sure that students and families are able to use information directly from the IRS to simplify the process of seeking financial aid. But that work on access is not enough. It's not enough to have access to opportunity if the opportunity is not of high quality. And part of what we mean by high quality is environments that protect and celebrate our diversity and environments that ensure that students complete. We celebrate, as Cecilia said, that we quite recently graduated the largest and most diverse class we've ever had from college. And yet, we also know that we still see significant gaps for our students of color, our low-income students, our first-generation college students, gaps in persistence and gaps in completion. We have more work to do. We have work to do to ensure that we build on the progress of the last 8 years. We have a million more African-American Latino students who've gone on to college because of investments that the administration has made and leadership of folks in this room, but we have to build on that work to close the gaps that we see. And we've got to acknowledge the tremendous role that income inequality plays in our higher education sector. A child of an affluent family today still 6 or 7 times more likely to earn a bachelor's degree by 24 as a student coming from a low-income family. To ensure the strength of our promise of equality of opportunity, we must tackle that by making sure our campuses are supportive environments for first-generation college students and low-income students. Certainly, there is much work being done by folks in this room to celebrate, and a broader societal recognition of the importance of this work. I think of the importance of the recent Supreme Court ruling about the University of Texas, where the Supreme Court affirmed the value and importance of diversity. The court agreed with the university's goal of creating an academic environment that offers, and I quote, a robust exchange of ideas, exposure to differing cultures, preparation for the challenges of an increasingly diverse workforce, and acquisition of competencies required of future leaders. The court described a compelling interest in diversity, and that interest is, I believe, greater than ever as we try to move past some of the divisions in our society. Now, that means, that commitment to diversity means interventions that ensure safety and support for students. It also means a commitment to faculty diversity. Hiring decisions matter. Ensuring that our faculty and our school staffs are representative of a diverse student body is critical, as is ensuring that all of our faculty and staff are prepared to support a diverse student body. We know that research shows that campus leadership, including a diverse faculty, plays an important role in achieving inclusive environments and improving completion rates. We know that faculty members benefit from support around curriculum and professional development that helps them to develop cultural competency. We know that training on implicit bias and stereotype threat can make a real difference in whether or not faculty and staff are able to make the environment one that is successful. I think of the example of at University of Mississippi, where they've introduced hate versus bias training for campus police officers and the Welcome Home Onboarding Program to provide new employees with professional development around issues of racial reconciliation. Think about the work that's happening at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, where their Office of Diversity and Academic Success in the Sciences has focused on ensuring that traditionally underrepresented students have access to the support they need to succeed in the sciences, including a summer preparatory program in chemistry and calculus that involves intensive academic support during the summer prior to students' freshman year, so that students are ready to excel in those critical gatekeeper courses in the sciences. Think about the work at Brown University, focused on providing socio-emotional support and resources for students, creating opportunities for students to create meaningful relationships across differences through community-building programs. Think about the work at University of Illinois and Chicago, where they focus on a faculty hiring initiative committed to diverse academic leadership and enriching students' learning experience. They are engaging not just faculty, but students in the work of ensuring that they recruit and retain a diverse faculty and support them in creating strong environments for all students. There are important investments that we're making. I think of the investment in the First in the World program focused on college completion, the TRIO programs that have such a long and rich history of providing supports like counseling and academic advising and summer bridge programs for first-generation college students. But there is much more to do. And when we look across our campuses and see some of the challenges we confront, when we look across our K-12 schools and see some of the challenges we confront, when folks have not had those experiences that build empathy, we know there's so much more to do. We've got to commit to more work on cultural competency and professional development for faculty and staff. We've got to commit to honest assessments of campus climate, the kinds of survey work that some of you are doing to make sure that we understand what students' experiences are like and how we can intervene to support them. We've got to do more work on student orientation and student coursework and student experiences that prepare them to succeed on diverse campuses and in a diverse world. We know that our young people today are likely to work in environments where they're colleague is of a different race, their supervisor practices a different religion, their customer speaks a different language, and their supplier is in another country. Our students will be better prepared for adulthood, and our adult students will be better prepared for success in the workplace if they have exposure to diversity that is well supported. It's critically important that we stand up as campus leaders, whether it is as administrators or faculty members, as students, on behalf of our students who are most vulnerable. We've got to stand up for our students of color and insist on safe environments. We've got to stand up for our female students and insist on environments free from sexism. We've got to stand up for our students who are in religious minority groups who may be wrongly persecuted based on their religion. We've got to stand up for our students regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity. We've got to stand up for our students regardless of their immigration status. We've got to stand up for the students who are most vulnerable. If not us, who? If not now, when? We have a moral responsibility to make our campuses places that embrace all of our students, because that's who we are as Americans. That is what we stand for. And our educational institutions are inextricably linked to our national commitment to equality of opportunity. Diversity is a fundamental value of who we are, and it must be lifted up in every educational institution. And we can't do it only when it's convenient, when there are incidents of racial harassment on campus, when there are incidents of anti-Muslim bias on campus. We have to respond swiftly, comprehensively. We've got to take on the hard conversations, because that is who we are as educators. I started by saying that our campuses are not immune to the divisiveness we're seeing across the country. And I also believe that our campuses are well positioned to exercise their academic and moral responsibility to be leaders in building unity and respect. I'm grateful to be in a room of people who share these values and these commitments, and I urge you to take on this tough work, to share best practice, to be loud voices for the protection of our students and our value of diversity. It's the right thing for pushing our institutions forward. Ultimately, it's the right thing for moving our country forward. Thanks so much for the opportunity.